Hello and welcome to the Personal Wealth Coach. Today we're going to be talking to you about some interesting things. Interesting. See what I did there with interest? And we're going to talk about inflation and the interest rates, and it's very interesting. And we'll give you disclosures later about how we like puns and such. So if you've made it past the introduction, we're going to be talking about the latest inflation reports and Chairman Powell's comments about still lowering rates sometime in 2024, probably twice. And we're going to talk about unemployment and the news that came where he said we're still going to be doing it. And Elder Baldy Jeff has some things to say about when you know what you're paying and who you're paying. So it's all going to be very interesting. And we'll be back on the other side of the bumper music with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. Once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
Hello and welcome to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jake and
Jeff
McClure. Together we are here to be bald and bearded and to enjoy...
And we're good at it too.
Yes, and to enjoy bad puns for no particular reason, but that's who we are. We're also here to give you an educational podcast. The Personal Wealth Coach is not just the name of this podcast. It's also an SEC-registered investment advisory firm. But we can't give investment advice on a podcast because too many people could hear us telling you stuff. And we prefer to be more private with our clients. Also, the SEC doesn't give us any kind of great distinction just because we are registered with them. It doesn't imply any great expertise or anything else. It does say that they are the ones to complain to should we say something that could damage the public. So we're going to be giving you education on this. And as I said, we're going to talk a bit about what Chairman Powell said today. We're recording on Wednesday, the 3rd of April. It will be released on the following Saturday. But Powell says that he still sees room for the Fed to cut rates this year. That's after we've had some slightly stiffer than expected inflation in the first couple of months of 2024. He said that, well, I'll give you the quote, and let me see if I can be as dry as the Federal Reserve Chairman. The recent data do not materially change the overall picture, which continues to be one of solid growth, a strong but rebalancing labor market, and inflation moving down to 2% on a sometimes bumpy path. What does that mean? Well, we talked about this about almost a year ago, about how the interest rates were going to be high for longer than people thought. If you can recall back that far, people were thinking they were just going to raise the rates and lower them back down almost immediately, and everything would be hunky-dory after that. And we said, nope, don't expect that. The Federal Reserve sees full employment in the United States with an unemployment around 4%, and we were around 3.4%. That means that we had more than full employment. That's like having 110%. It doesn't make sense mathematically. What it means is that we were pulling people into employment that usually would have been quite comfortably unemployed, that we had enough wages to offer to bring people who would normally not be looking for work into the workforce. And since then, unemployment's up to 3.9%. Now, that doesn't sound horrible, but it doesn't sound as good as 3.4%. It seems like just, you know, 0.5% difference. What's the big deal? Well, the big deal is that interest rates being high makes it more expensive to hire people. Most new employees at a company are hired using debt, short-term loans to hire some more people, buy some new equipment. And the Federal Reserve's interest rates being up slowed that down. When we said that we should expect to see a 4% unemployment before we see interest rates coming back down. And that's essentially what Chairman Powell said today. He said that we're in good shape. The labor market is solid growth. It's rebalancing from one position to another. You've got some stuff to add to that. Where are these people coming from? Because it's not like we're laying off huge numbers of people right now. In fact, we're seeing the February report from the Labor Department said that we hired 275,000 people in February. A normal, what you would expect to see hiring going on would be in the 120,000 to 150,000 range. This is significantly more than that. Where are the people coming from? And I bet there's something you can add to that as you wanted to talk about it.
There's a interesting thing going on, because the people who are looking at that were also asked, other people were asking questions. Why is the rest of the world facing some kind of financial unhappiness?
The rest of the world.
A recession, right? or growth insufficient to keep the economy going someplace in China, or what's different about the United States? And what came out in some publications from The Economist and the Financial Times is that it apparently is the influx of immigrants over the last couple of years. And we're not talking about illegal immigration here. We're talking about people who are in the United States, who have immigrated to the United States, and who start businesses. And there's a really fascinating statistic here, and I won't give you the exact on it, because we get boring after a while. But immigrants who come in and start businesses, and they start more businesses than you would imagine. They love to come in and start businesses. And matter of fact, if you travel around the country, you will see that there'll be an independent motel someplace, and there will be a person who's obviously not born in the United States running it.
Same with gas stations. Same with basically gas stations, new gas stations showing up. It's most likely going to be first generation person who started it.
First or second generation. Same thing's true of car repair places and so on. So what happens is we had this influx of people who came in who are really happy to be here and really want to make it well and really want to live the American dream. And they started working really, really hard and being very productive. Okay, that's good. But what happened to this unemployment thing? We have averaged over the last several months about 250,000 people a month net new jobs. Now, when we say new people hired, that's net of the people who got laid off or got fired or whatever. So when we were at 275,000 in February, nobody really expected it to be that high that I could find. And yet, this is the interesting part about that. We hired 275,000 more people, which is a lot.
Where'd they come from?
Well, then the unemployment rate increased 2 points to 3.9%. So our unemployment rate is going up, and we're hiring people faster than anybody expected. What's going on? It's the immigrants. They're coming into the United States.
And we're talking about legal. We're not talking about the illegal. Right. Let's get out of politics for a second. These are people that came over properly. Otherwise, they wouldn't be part of the unemployment numbers. That would be in the black market area.
You can't very well count them as employed if they're not showing up as employed, and they can't get employed unless they can prove they're here legally. Legally employed, reportable employees is what we're talking about.
Right.
They're having taxes withheld, and they're having their Social Security withheld and all of that. So all these people are coming in, and they're going into healthcare, government, food services, drinking places. Does this sound familiar?
Sure does.
They are not going into the high-tech world. They're not going into manufacturing. They're going into the people who clean the floors in the healthcare facilities, the people who are in food service. They're the people who are waiting tables and are flipping hamburgers and drinking places. They're cleaning up in there and they're serving in there. So what we've got, and warehousing, they're going into warehousing too. So what we've got is this flood of people coming into the United States that is raising the unemployment rate, because our workforce, which was static for a really long time, very, very little growth, the workforce is growing. The number of unemployed people increased by 334,000 last month to 6.5 million. Now,
when we
think about this just a minute.
In net new jobs, we've got more people being hired than being laid off, but the number of unemployed people rose.
Mm-hmm. A year earlier, the jobless rate was at 3.6%. In other words, we had a lower unemployment rate, but we only had 6 million people unemployed. Now we have 6.5 million people unemployed and a higher unemployment rate, which makes sense. Here's what's happening. Think about the average we've been having. If we just keep this up, we don't do anything different. 250,000 net new employees a month. That means every 4 months we employ 1 million people. We will employ 3 million more people a year from now that are employed today, which is, by the way, about what we've gained in the last year. And then that is why the United States economy is not slipping, because when these people get hired, they're spending money. They're buying things. And when they buy things, it causes businesses to have profits. And when businesses have profits, it causes the GDP to go up. Now, let's contrast that, if I could. China, flat, doesn't allow outsiders to come in and work. In Europe, they pretty much shut down immigration because they had some really unpleasant experiences with people out of the Middle East and North Africa. And so the two other major economies, the Japanese, no, you're not welcome to come in and work in Japan, period. Even though they're getting really, really old and they're trying to figure out where they're going to find workers. If you're not Japanese, you're not welcome. In the United States, probably 95 or better percent of the people who are listening to us right now had ancestors who immigrated here. And that's the nature of this country. And it is probably one of the root causes of American exceptionalism.
And now let me give you kind of some framing for this. When we say 1 million people a year, that sounds huge. But we've got 330 million people in our country.
3 million a year.
3 million.
250 new employees.
Right. So 3 million a year. We're talking about 1%, less than 1% growth per year, which is not going to somehow dilute the ethics and culture of the United States. That's the other end of this. When we're talking about legal immigration, it's a different story from talking about waves of people storming the border. That's a different thing. Please don't get confused about this. We're talking about the way it's supposed to happen. People with correct visas, going through the correct process to become citizens, and paying taxes. This isn't the leech scare that is big if you're in union on the Democrat side or if you're populist on the Republican side. Both sides are afraid of this, by the way. So when you put it together and look at this as a whole, American exceptionalism takes place after major world catastrophes. You can look back at World War I, and we had a big population boom in the United States after World War I. If you look at every major world disaster, and then you look at the population jump in the United States afterwards, it doesn't matter if we're talking about a potato famine or COVID. It's led to immigration to the United States, and those that come properly, legally, tend to add so much more to our system in their approach because they're utterly committed to it. They have sacrificed everything to come here. So just to putting that in context with, you hear bad things from both sides of the politics. And I know if you're a Republican, you think Democrats are all about open borders and immigration. And if you're a Democrat, you think the Republicans just hate everything. The reality is that nobody wants a dilution, or very few people want a dilution of what we hold dear in the United States. And part of that is merit for pay for merit. The better you work, the harder you work, the more you should be paid. If you're creating things that are of value, you should be paid for it. That's the United States. So that's really the subject that I had to talk about here. And Chairman Powell, Jerome, when he goes about raising or lowering rates, he's not thinking directly about the immigration side of things, but he's got to think about it to some extent. And what he said today was that we're still on track for sometime later in the year, two different interest rate drops, probably a total of 0.5% drop in interest rates. And we have a question from Inquisitor John that is very directly on that subject. And that is, when will it be time to wade back into bonds? And the answer to that is, it can always be a good time to be in bonds if you have a good deal. What does that mean? If you're making a loan to somebody who you know will pay you back, and they're willing to pay you an interest rate that you believe is a good interest rate, you should make that loan. Now, the question about should you sell it to someone else and will you make a profit if you sell that loan to someone else? That's a different question. If you're approaching each bond purchase, each loan you make, based on what is the credit of the person you're giving a loan to and what's the interest rate, then it's reasonable to be in bonds at any point. If you need to sell that bond quickly, then it needs to be a competitive rate or you're going to lose money. And on the shorter end of bonds, if we know that Chairman Powell is saying we're going to be dropping rates later in the year, you probably don't want to be owning, you don't want to be buying a bunch of stuff to sell now. You could make a profit by selling a higher rate when rates drop. Do we recommend that as a, hey, you should make a lot of money doing that? There are people that do the trading on that that are really astute at this, and I wouldn't recommend going up against them in a competition. So if you're talking about bond funds, there's still some danger there. We believe that interest rates on long-term bonds are likely to continue to rise even after the Federal Reserve starts to lower the short-term interest rates. And that's not a good thing to be buying up bonds when you think that interest rates are going to be going up. That will cause you to lose some money. And I don't want to get too much into that because people tend to go to sleep. Interest rates are less interesting to other people than to us usually. But just being aware that the longer-term rates have a tendency to even out higher than the shorter term rates, and they're not there yet. We know the shorter term rates are likely to drop, but the very, very long term averages for long term rates are significantly above where they are now. So, and what we've been seeing, even on days when Jerome Powell says we're going to be lowering rates, is we see a slight uptick in interest rates on the longer term bonds. It's inverted. Long term rates are too low and short term rates are too high. We expect that to reverse. So I wouldn't recommend jumping into bonds as a great way of doing investing unless you're the one making the loan and you're willing to hold it until they pay you back. And that's reasonable.
Well, I also have a comment on bonds. I was just looking at that today because I had a question about that from someone. And frankly, there's an easy way. Bond indices are hard to find and they're not very reliable. But what you can do is you can go on Morningstar and go to something like, and I'm not recommending you invest in this at all, Vanguard's Total Bond Market Index Fund. And it'll tell you exactly what would have happened to $10,000 over any given period of time. And it's not really very pleasant because if you go back to the beginning for that particular fund, the Total Bond Market Index Fund, Admiral Shares, the average annual rate of return has been 3.19%. Now, guess what inflation has been since that time period? Just about the same thing.
Yep. I was going to say to even out. You tend to get this very close to a break even there.
Basically, if you'd held this fund or something similar to it, from 2001, when it opened, to the present, you would have fewer dollars today than you had. It's actually down 7.7% from where you would have started in 2001. And then there's been inflation, and I don't have all the numbers on inflation, but from 2007 to the present, well, over that time period, the value of the dollar has dropped by about half, which means if you'd invested $1,000 in that fund at that point, you'd have $423.50 worth of value today. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean bonds are always terrible? No. During periods of rising long-term interest rates, bonds lose money on the secondary market.
Right.
That's reality. If you hold them to maturity, you've lost whatever inflation was over that period if you break even. And that's really important to understand. But that's, I just wanted to add that to what you said. Then I got what I have to say.
Okay. Go ahead. What do you have
to say? Which is a different subject. Yeah. I was noticing that there was a new hedge fund opened up, and it was opening up on the idea that when there is a scoop about some industry or some out of the news media. In other words, the news media has a scoop that says the XYZ company has got caught with their fingers in the pickle jar or whatever, and the SEC is probably going to hammer them.
I've always heard of it as a cookie jar, but pickle jar is just a bit more on the sour side.
Well, I'm mixing my metaphors here very nicely.
No, very good. Getting a cookie out of the pickle jar. Pickle jar. There we go.
So the hedge fund is being formed to, as soon as they get that news, before people can react, they think they can get to the market quicker and sell the companies that have bad news about them. Now, whether or not that's going to work or not is obviously totally unknown, because they're going to be shorting and there's a lot of risks assorted with that, just like there is with any hedge fund. But it raised the question as to what fund, what they had bought so far. And they bought the shares of a mortgage brokerage firm that has lots and lots and lots and lots of so-called independent mortgage brokers working all over the country who have been, they got caught telling their contracted salespeople that they are independents and they're working in the best interest of the person who comes to get the mortgage loan. And they think, and by the way, the stock price, by the way, immediately plunged because they basically are guilty of false advertising and there will probably be huge class action lawsuits against them. But it brought up something. I've gotten mortgages before, and I never paid a fee to the mortgage broker.
Somebody did.
Somebody did. In other words, the mortgage broker said, my services will cost you $3,000. They didn't say that. They just said, here's your mortgage. And I recall asking, what do I pay you for this? And literally, I got this very standard answer that used to be standard in other places, but the regulators got them. You don't pay me. The mortgage company does. Yeah, sure. Where do they get the money to pay you? And that's the question I haven't asked, but where do they get the, I know where they get the money. They get the money by taking it from you, which means that the company that pays your mortgage broker the most money is the, and there's no assurance that any given mortgage broker will always go to the place that'll pay them the most money to do something. But it is in the nature of human beings to respond well to whoever pays them and to respond better if they pay them more.
Right. And what we find is that the companies that pay the mortgage brokers, and I'm going to put air quotes around this, independent mortgage brokers the most are the ones that the independents use the most.
So that makes them shocking.
Less independent than you think they are.
And we have seen over the years, and having been a broker, I have heard this many times that I was supposed to say it when I was a broker many years ago.
Stockbroker, not mortgage broker. Yeah.
That if somebody asks you how much they're paying for that, that was the standard answer is you're not paying me anything, the company pays me. And the issue is, oddly enough, the companies that were paying me a lot of money were the ones I was working for. Now, if you're employed someplace, you probably get paid by somebody and you tend to work for the somebody you pay that's paying you, not the person who's not paying. This is a particular reality in the investment world, because in an investment, you don't see what you get. You don't go out and measure the price against all the other. At that particular moment, when you purchase an investment through a broker or a financial advisor or whatever that you're purchasing through, you don't go out and check all the prices. Otherwise, you wouldn't be using that person. We do, as a matter of fact, spend a tremendous amount of time checking prices, and we are obligated to find the lowest price. What does that mean? If you're working with a fiduciary to whom you are paying a disclosed fee, I'm paying, I'll give you an example of somebody who's this exact thing is happening. I'm having somebody do repairs on my house right now. I am paying them a specific fee for their time and another specific amount for the parts that they go and buy. And I can check the price of the things they're buying to see if it's an appropriate price. Now, in the construction industry, I'll be the first to tell you that sometimes the vendors do pay some money under the table to the people who repair houses. And I'm aware of that, and we've discussed that. On the other side of it, I'm having a vehicle repair done right now and an upgrade to one of my vehicles, and it's going to cost me a significant amount of money. And I'm aware of that. And they break it down into, we're charging you this much an hour, and we work this many hours, and here's the cost of parts, and they're not getting a kickback. Can I trust that person? Yes. I can compare what they charge for hour compared with what somebody else charges for hour to work on the same vehicle. And I can say, and I can see the quality of the work they're doing. That's good. If you're purchasing securities through using an IRA, I don't care how you're doing, whether it's bonds or stocks or whatever, it's critical to know how much money the person who is recommending a security to you or who's doing a trade for you is making off of your business. How much are they being paid? And if they won't answer the question, or they dodge the question and tell you that you don't pay them anything, they're working for free, that means that if they were to tell you, one of two things is true. Either they're unaware of it, which is generally not the truth, or if you knew how much you were paying, you would scream and go running out the door. And remember that if you have a financial advisor who says, who doesn't charge you fees and doesn't claim to be a fiduciary on a regular basis and fully disclose fees, meaning this is exactly what I'm charging you and nothing else, and they tell you that, then you probably are paying more than you want to hear about, and that you probably would be unhappy if you knew how much they were making off of that business. Because it's money that comes out of your pocket. And that's just my soapbox for the day is if you have any significant amount of money, enough that you hope to be or are financially independent, you really need to know exactly what fees you're paying. And you really need to know that the people who you are paying it to are not making money someplace else. And we talked about that last week when there was fees for trade volume.
Right. Payment for order flow. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the concept of, hey, it's a free trade just means that they're getting paid in a way that you can't see easily. That's all it means. All right. Well, that's it for this particular podcast. If you would like to talk to us, not on a podcast, and get some advice or some management of your investments, that's what we do. And we do it at a fiduciary level. And we even tell you how much we're charging and all that good stuff. We actually only work for our clients. You can call us locally and get voicemail on the weekend, real live people during the week at
254-947-1111.
Or toll free, should you still have a landline, 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our website, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, where you can see our famously made for podcast faces, our wonderful staff. You can read about what we do and how we do it. You can read our newsletters going back a long ways. Sign up for it or just read it there. You can also look at our veritable morgue of old recordings of podcasts and radio programs going back years. See what we had to say in the depths of the pandemic and what we had to say after that. It's worth checking out. In the meantime, thank you very much for listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. We appreciate you, and we'll be back to you next episode.